Right. I think let's make a start. So good morning. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner with NPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice based in the southeast of England, but we work with clients all over the world that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. Delighted to be joined this morning by my colleague, Adrienne Hardy. Morning, Adrienne. And today, as you'll see from our invite, is all about 2P top tips. Now, we've only got 30 minutes in this session. The session is going to be recorded. It's going to be put onto our website and on Spotify in the usual way as well. If you've got any questions, there is a chat function down at the, a question function down at the bottom of your screen. So by all means, fire away questions. We'll try and deal with them as we go along, or if there's time at the end, we'll also do our best to pick them up as well. We're not going to open anybody's microphone or identify anybody or anything like that. So don't be afraid to fire off your 2P related questions and we'll see what we can do with them. We've only got half an hour. 2P is such a massive topic. Of course, we're not going to be able to cover it in absolute great detail today. But what we did want to do in this session was just highlight our top tips in relation to the exercises that we've been involved in. Really, we should have called this session today, watch out for some pitfalls, because it is one of those areas where there are quite a few elephant traps and you can unwittingly create some quite large liabilities if you're not planning ahead for 2P. So hopefully we'll cover off some of those elephant traps for you as well. So what is 2P, or 2P as a client once said? In a nutshell, it's a set of business regulations that mean when you transfer a function or part of a business, then all of the employees are entitled to transfer across with it. Now, there are sort of three main scenarios where 2P is actually triggered. So in terms of a sale of a business, there are a couple of ways of selling a business. If it's the shares that are sold within a business, then normally that's just the ownership of the business behind it, which is changing. The business itself stays intact. Usually 2P does not apply to a pure share sale. However, there are some circumstances where there can be change of control provisions which do actually trigger 2P. But the general rule is a share sale alone will not trigger 2P obligations. 2P will apply if the actual business itself is being sold. So we're talking about things like the goodwill in the business, client contracts, plant, machinery, property, all that sort of stuff. When all of that is sold and the business is moved over, then 2P is triggered in those situations. The second situation, of course, this may be very familiar to you, is where part of a business is sold. So a larger company, for example, might want to divest part of its business, sell off a division or a particular function. And normally that's going to be a sale which triggers 2P as well. So the employees that are part of that function which is being sold, in theory, will transfer over to the purchaser. And then there's a third area as well, Adrienne, isn't there?
Yeah, so you've got the classic outsourcing example, which I'm sure most of you have come across. And that's where, you know, a company might decide that a particular function is going to be sent out to a third party for them to do. And sort of typical examples of that might be an IT function. You hear a lot about we've outsourced our IT function. So you give that to another company to run for you. And equally, as often happens, because I don't know about you guys, but I find these things go in cycles. There's a big push to outsource things. And then the company goes, oh, I think we'll have a change of heart. And then you decide that you bring it back in-house. And the bringing it back in-house means that you've got a second outsourcing or insourcing, and 2P applies to that. So you send your employees out on the first bit, and then you bring them back in on the second bit, and 2P will apply to both. I mean, some other, I always think that outsourcing is a great business idea, that's fine, but sometimes it can lead to, you know, not very much in the way of dealing with employee issues. And weirdly enough, most of the case law around 2P just tend to be sort of like cleaning companies. So a classic example is you outsource your cleaning of your office premises. That's if you still have office premises after the pandemic, of course. But you outsource your cleaning to a company. you think, oh my God, these cleaners are crap, let's change. And you think, right, we're going to go to a different company now. And you bring in a different company only to find that Tupi operates so that exactly the same cleaners you had in place employed by one company now transferred under Tupi to the new company. And bingo, the same people arrive to clean your offices, maybe wearing a slightly different uniform. And that's a classic example of a Tupi outsourcing. And I may be completely cynical and I apologize for that. So I know I've just obviously been doing this job for too long, clearly. So just sort of what your obligations are under Tupi, and there's a few of them. Most of you will have heard of the duty to inform and consult your affected employees. And this is it's one of those very precise processes, and it takes some time to plan. And I remember once in very early on in my career, I was pulled into a corporate deal at the last minute, as often happens when people suddenly go, oh God, we forgot about the employees. And I had to break the news to our client that they had to go through a Tupi consultation process. And they weren't very happy. They were like, God, do we have to do this? Do we have to elect employee reps and set up a consultation process? Do we really have to do it? And I said, well, no, of course you don't. It's absolutely fine. But if you're just okay to get your checkbook out, because you're going to probably have to write a check for failure to inform and consult, which is up to 13 weeks actual pay per employee. So that's the penalty if you don't go through that information and consultation process. Did you want to say something? You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I did. Exactly. I was just going to say, on the 13 weeks pay liability, and this is the real sort of sting in the tail if you get your obligations to inform consult wrong. You know, if you're looking at if you've got 100 employees, for example, you know, you're multiplying 100 times 13 weeks pay, and it's not capped. So when we're normally talking about weeks pay as employment lawyers, we're talking about a capped liability. If you think in terms of how you do your statutory redundancy pay calculations and the like, there's normally a cap on that. When it comes to this particular award, it's uncapped, and you've got to look at gross pay. And I think the reason for that partly is that it is a punitive sanction. So, you know, most of the times when we're talking about sanctions in employment law, we're looking at compensatory. So putting people back into the position that they would have been in, but for a dismissal, for example. With this, it's very much a stick to beat you with. So how much of a mistake have you made? And the tribunals will start at 13 weeks pay, and they'll move back on a sliding scale to zero pay, depending on how culpable they think you are. And I think it's also worth mentioning that there's potential for joint and several liability with the transferee. And apologies, I know that we're using some technical terms, and those of you who are not as familiar with 2P may not have come across them, but transferor and transferee, the parties on either side of the 2P transaction, so the outgoing employer and the incoming employer. And there are certain obligations where you're both jointly liable if things do go wrong. So I appreciate that that's kind of a very high level introduction to what we're talking about when we're referring to 2P itself. But nevertheless, we're going to go on and just talk about our topic. So the first one from me is, and it sounds an obvious one, but really you've got to think about whether or not 2P does actually apply to a given situation. So if, for example, you're told that there's going to be some sort of restructure, you want to think about 2P. Just go through that process. Is there scope for 2P to apply to this scenario? If you're told that the business will be sold, think about 2P. Within a restructure, a whole function might be affected, but what's happening to that function? Is it going somewhere else? Is there going to be an outsourcing? Is part of it being outsourced? Are you in-housing something? So to pick up on what Adrienne was talking about, have you had a scenario where you've outsourced some activity and you're bringing it back in-house? Or have you got a situation where you've outsourced some activity, the provider isn't very good, you're switching provider, so we've got what's called a second generation outsourcing. You know, all of those things are going to potentially trigger 2P. So go through that process. Before we get onto your tip, there has been a question. So thanks, Emma, for your question. And it does relate to this. It's what are the common pitfalls when you're separating two companies? They remained owned by the same person, but separate contracts and payroll, and now operate as two separate beings. Well, exactly what I've just said, basically. The first thing is to figure out, does 2P actually apply to that given scenario? Because it might or it might not. And you know, one issue we do encounter fairly regularly is situations where there's an intergroup transfer, and the assumption is, mistaken assumption is, well, we're all part of the big group, therefore 2P isn't triggered because we're not actually sending this company or these employees anywhere externally. 2P can still apply to intergroup transfers as well. So if you're rejigging how group companies operate, and that can include separating one company into two separate legal entities, so the identity of the employer changes, then 2P could be triggered in that scenario. So I think the big watch out in terms of that question is, if 2P applies, making sure that you do what 2P obliges you to do.
That example where you're separating two companies, you'd need a big sheet of paper, and you'd be, you know, mapping out who might be staying in one company and who might be moving to another. And for those people that are moving, how are they moving? How's that been affected? And that's where the 2P may arise. But that also then ties in with another question that we've just had, where the question is, in my company, we're moving employees, sort of an internal 2P, but we will inform and not consult. So in that situation, you can very often say, right, we're going to move a bunch of employees from their existing entity into another one. But in essence, the only thing that's going to change is going to be the name of the employer, nothing else. So in that situation, you're going to be informing them that it's going to happen. But because there aren't actually going to be any changes other than the name of the employer, then you're fine to do that.
Yeah, and that, again, there are workarounds with that, aren't there, Adrienne, when you're dealing, because I think, understandably, the risk profile where you're dealing with employees where it's what we would call a relatively straightforward change is going to be a lot lower than if you're sending them to a third-party company they don't know about and they're worried about hours and pay and all the things that are important to employees being affected. There are workarounds that we use. It's all a question of risk, what kind of legal risk the business has an appetite for, but there are ways of making it very easy to go through that consultation process, because still, even in that intracompany transfer scenario, if you're dealing with, say, 50 employees, technically, you know, you've got to give them the right to elect employee representatives. Mm-hmm. And do you really want to go through that process if you're just literally changing the identity of their legal employer from one group company name to another? The law says you do need to, but there are ways and steps that we can take to manage it if you're up for a, you know, a bit of legal risk, basically.
Yeah. Okay, so just come to...
So you're looking at point two.
Yeah, so our second sort of top tip slash trap is double check who transfers, because it's never as straightforward as you think. You might outsource, you know, you might outsource your IT department, for example, and you've got a bunch of IT support desk employees. You go, right, they're the ones that are moving. But what about anybody else who might be impacted? So what about the IT manager? What about the IT director, dare I say? You know, it's about working out who's in scope. There is an additional thing to be concerned about, and there is case law in this as well, where you might have a bunch of contractors. So say typically in an IT example where you've got employees who sit at the next desk to somebody who might be a contractor, hopefully because of your IR35 audit, that may not be the case anymore. But, you know, you could have a situation where you've got a bunch of contractors and 2P doesn't apply to anybody who isn't an employee. But it brings us back round to the classic set of cases on employment status. So those contractors who aren't covered by 2P, but who you don't need anymore, will suddenly be, you know, quite disgruntled by the fact that you're probably saying, well, we're going to terminate your contracts now because we're outsourcing it. And that's the point where they might say, oh, well, in actual fact, we're not contractors, we're employees. We've been working here for 6 years. We do exactly the same job as the employees. And you end up in a situation where you've got a bunch of people you haven't consulted with. So you end up with not only unfair dismissal claims, but potentially you've excluded them from your information and consultation process. And so I suppose in terms of the tip, it's like be alive to this and just work out in advance how you're going to manage it. Are you going to take the chance? Are you going to wrap them in with the consultation process and say, you know, technically you're contractors and therefore you're not employees, but we're going to pull you into the process anyway so that you're informed. At least then it's going to minimize your risk of a claim for the failure to inform and consult.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully everyone that's on this call is super, super diligent in their businesses in terms of getting their arms around employee status, not because there's an impending 2P transfer, but just because employee status has been such a hot topic with all the IR35 changes and the like, gig economy type issues that we've been talking about for, it feels like a long time now, the last 4 or 5 years. But yeah, absolutely, you know, just echoing what Adrienne says, it goes into that knowing who's going to be transferring, and that starts with really just an audit of who do we employ, who do we have as contractors as well, and is there any scope for a bit of ambiguity there, and if so, what's our contingency plan for managing that? Next one I've got is getting the relevant employee information. Now 2P just does provide for something called employee liability information, so when you look into the regulations, you can read for yourselves, it's very specific in there about exactly the information that if you're the transferor, you need to provide to the transferee. And if you're the transferee, so you're the company that's inheriting the employees, you know what information you can expect the transferor to be giving you. Now, that information is just the legal information. Bear in mind, in a lot of these processes, there will be a contractual agreement between buyer and seller. And where we get involved in employment lawyers, we're not corporate lawyers, but where we plug into what corporate lawyers do is working on those contracts and just looking at the provisions and in some cases drafting and inserting provisions about any additional information that we think should be provided in a given scenario. So things to check, not just what the 2P regs say you have to provide, but also as a matter of commercial contract between the parties, what information do you also need to provide as well?
It's also the time as well, isn't there? You know, the regulations are very restrictive on the time frame. So say you're the transferee, so you're the receiving employer, the transferor under 2P only has to provide you with a minimum amount of information 28 days before the date of the transfer. Yeah. Now, you know, depending on the scope of the transfer, that's not going to be soon enough for you to be able to do all your planning. You know, if you're thinking about onboarding a whole bunch of people, 28 days is really not long enough. So it's making sure that you can get your hands on as much information about who you're going to be receiving in advance. And I always think that 28 days is nuts, though, don't you, Peter? I mean, it's crazy. You've got an informed consent.
I'm just trying to remember whether that was the rule change, because I think when I started this job years ago, it wasn't even a 28-day. I think it was expressed as in good time.
Yeah. And so the old regs didn't have any time limit. It was only the 2006 regs that brought it in. Exactly. So, you know, hey, we're going to inform and consult with you, but we don't really know what about because no one's told us yet. No, 28 days hasn't started to run.
Now, related to that employee liability information is when you're digging down into the information, yes, you might just be working from employment contracts, but as we know, employment contracts have got a habit of not actually reflecting what's going on the ground. I'm sure you've come across issues before where people, it turns out they're doing a different job to what's in their employment contract, they're paid at a different rate, they're working in a different location. We found that a lot because of COVID, people are suddenly dotted around across Europe. You've got to make sure that you are digging down into the information. So are there hidden bonuses that are being paid, for example? Is there a disgruntled employee who doesn't want to transfer, who's been promised a promotion, for example, and as the transferee, are you going to be liable for them promoting that person? So really, the minimum information in 2P is just that. It's kind of bare minimum information. And, you know, you'll be well served to, you know, think a bit more holistically about exactly what it is that's going to be helpful.
I'm going to chuck in a bit of immigration there because everybody knows that immigration is my favourite thing in the whole world. No, it isn't really. Maybe second only to data protection. But just on the immigration point as well, look out for anybody that the outgoing employer, so the transferor, they may well have a sponsor licence, they may well have skilled workers. And if they're doing a 2P transfer and your obligation is to take on the staff, and you don't have a sponsor license, you're going to have to get one really quickly because the employee has the right to transfer and you are then obliged to take them on and you'll have to get a sponsor license. So it's worthwhile like just looking out and asking the right questions on that as well. That's a whole different topic though.
It is. Yeah, we could talk for an hour on that, I think, and scare people. But let's save that for another one session, right? Halloween.
Yeah. Okay, so I think then, so just we're talking about the mechanics of the transfer, but planning is probably the key top tip, actually. Plan, and plan some more. So, you know, you might be taking on the employees, What are you going to do with them? Are there going to be redundancies? How, you know, if you're bringing two companies together, what is going to be the impact of that GP transfer? You know, for example, you may not need two finance teams. You may acquire a company, or you may acquire part of the business, but you don't need all of the employees that are coming across. So it's making sure that you think about what's going to be your approach to this before the transfer. So are you going to be doing redundancies? Are you going to be changing terms? Whatever. And it's always worthwhile thinking through all of these things and mapping it out well in advance. I think one of the things I thought about as well is if you're doing, I mean, with redundancy, again, it's a massive topic on its own, but there's now provision under the rules where you can start pre-transfer consultation on a redundancy, but the, you know, how you make people redundant in a GP context is extremely complicated, and that's well full of pitfalls as well. So I would always say, be, you know, have a war chest. I know that sounds awful, but be prepared to pay enhanced terms to outgoing staff, or you can even have a discussion with the outgoing employer to see if they're prepared to make their staff redundant before they even come across. Because from an employee relations point of view, there's nothing more irritating than, you know, going through a GP consultation only then to sit down with employees that have just come across to you in the first week and go, hey, welcome to the company. Now we're going into redundancy consultation. That doesn't feel particularly fair.
No, and I think something that you said there about talking to the other party on the opposite side of the transaction is really valuable, actually. You know, the more communication and, I suppose, in a way, teamwork and understanding that you can get with the other side, the better it will be for both parties to it, and the easier everybody's life will be as well. You don't want to be in a sort of competitive situation where you're not, you know, there's a lot of friction there in the relationship, because you are going to need to collaborate on information sharing, and, you know, the better that relationship can rub along, the easier it is. So I think to add, you know, to that planning stage, it's factoring the communications with the opposing side, and, you know, work out a plan for information sharing and who's going to be responsible for what. On the redundancy point as well, I think just bear in mind, if you're an organisation that has a contractual redundancy entitlement, then, you know, all terms and conditions of contracts transfer over. So any contractual entitlements can move over and follow the employees as well. And, you know, I've seen scope for debate before about whether an enhanced redundancy payment process actually forms part of someone's terms and conditions of employment or not, when there's been that standard practice of an employer always paying a certain set amount that's known within a business. So that's a watch out. My next tip is about equivalent benefits. This is something that crops up all the time. Employees have the right to transfer on their existing terms of contract and with continuity of employment. So they're not starting employment from day one again when they transfer over. Their continuity of service is moved with them. Really, you've got to think of it as the new employer is completely stepping into the shoes of the outgoing employer as if they were the original employer all along. Now, we know that in reality, sometimes it's really difficult to replicate some of the benefits that have been offered by a previous employer. You know, things like car sharing schemes. Always seems to be questions I get about cars for some reason. But, you know, cycle to work schemes, you know, all sorts of things where there's a difference in benefit alignment. But sometimes it's not going to be possible for you to offer what the employees have had before. So you're just required to do your utmost, basically, to try and replicate those benefits. And if you really, really can't, then you just got to try and be creative in terms of what you can offer, but look to offer a substantially equivalent arrangement.
Yeah. My next tip is, remember that your staff can actually object to the transfer. They can refuse. They don't have to. I mean, obviously, we're not in a time of slavery. But if an employee chooses not to transfer and says, we don't want to, that's their right under TUPE. But the impact of that is that their employment simply comes to an end. It's not a dismissal in law. Their employment will simply just end on the date of their transfer, because this goes hand in hand with the idea of the new employer stepping into the shoes of the old employer. If the employee says, I'm objecting to the transfer, then, you know, the employer isn't dismissing, the employee is just literally going to stop. So there's no dismissal, which means that they wouldn't have a claim for unfair dismissal. Now, my only caveat there is that usually an employee will refuse to transfer if they're unhappy about something. That's most likely to be a change to their contract, even though terms and conditions aren't meant to change. We all know that there are, that happens as part of the discussions. Now, if the employee is really disgruntled and says, I don't like the fact that you're going to take away my car allowance, for example, they can resign and claim constructive dismissal in that situation because the transfer is going to be adverse for them.
Yeah, I think I come across this misconception sometimes from employees who think, well, I don't want to go and work for this company because I don't like them. You know, I've not heard great things about them in the market and I just want to stay where I am. So I'm going to object to the transfer and that means I can just carry on with my employment, my current employer. No, that's not the way it works. As Adrienne has said, your employment will just then terminate. It ends by operation of law. Now, I suppose this next bit falls into the big box of fudge category that we go and dip into from time to time. There are ways of taking employees out of scope of the transfer. And, you know, that's quite common. You get situations in outsourcing exercises where, you know, let's say employees that the outgoing employer might not want to retain are kind of dumped into a pool, and they're the ones who are suddenly the transferring employees, and all the good employees they want to retain are miraculously suddenly out of scope for 2P. That will dovetail in with the commercial contracts that are in place. If you've got well-drafted commercial contracts dealing with the transaction, then there'll be a prohibition on moving and effectively dumping rubbish employees into the 2P pool to avoid this from happening. So that's also something to think about. My next tip is to expect disputes. Now, the best will in the world, there won't be any disputes, but unless it is a super smooth process, when you're onboarding transferring employees, it can be difficult. So if you're the incoming employer, you need a contingency and a plan for dealing with disputes. Hopefully the due diligence that you do is going to identify early on where you might have some problems, and you will have identified and planned if there's going to be any post-transfer redundancy situations, for example. On the other side of the transaction, if you're the outgoing employer, where I've seen scope for disputes before is actually where employees are saying, hey, I don't want to transfer over to this company. They're also saying, I don't want to object because I know that that means my employment ends. But I think you, current employer, it's really a redundancy situation, isn't it? So pay me this nice big fat redundancy payment, please. And I think as the outgoing employee, you need to be quite firm and say, well, no, actually, we're not making you redundant. It isn't a redundancy situation. The work is transferring and you're part of the pool of employees that are actually transferring across.
Right. Harmonizing terms, which is what everybody wants to do. So you have a bunch of employees land in your lap and their terms and conditions that they've transferred over on are very different from your existing employees. So you end up with this two-tier, sometimes three, four-tier workforce. And what you really want is you want everybody to be on the same terms. Frankly, this is a bit of a nightmare topic and one that can justify a lengthy session on its own. But, you know, very often it may be that it's just not possible to do it. You can try and negotiate some changes, but if you are literally trying to, you know, say, right, here's our new contract of employment, we'd like you to sign up to it, then changing terms and conditions in connection with a transfer means that they are void. So what happens is you get the employee to sign the new contract, then 5 years later they decide they want to leave and you think that you can rely on the terms of those contract. They argue that that contract is void because it was put in place in connection with the transfer. So very often you simply have to wait a while until you've got past the transfer, until you can come up with a reason as to why there is a commercial, non-cheapy related reason for you changing their terms and conditions. And that can be anything. That can be a restructure, that can be, you know, maybe a loss of a client contract, or, you know, a promotion, for example, where somebody is, you know, you put them into a higher role and you use that opportunity to get them onto a new contract. But, you know, it's not an easy situation to go through that harmonisation process, and that of itself requires an awful lot of planning. I'm just going to revisit one of the questions that came up in the Q&A box, and I think the question was, would this not go in the measures letter? And I think that question relates to my somewhat flippant comment where I said, welcome to the new world, and now we're going to make you redundant. Absolutely. any measures that would be taken post-transfer that might mean redundancies. And in this situation, that might mean changing terms and conditions. All of that needs to go into the measures letter, which is the letter provided by the new employer outlining what changes it's proposing to make, and not just in relation to a contract, but more widely in relation to the employment. And that forms the subject matter of the consultation. Yeah. I just wanted to answer that question there.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, same goes for anything taken in respect of benefits, you know, employee benefits as well. We've got a couple more tips before we get on to them. Just wanted to say, I think this is our 13th, maybe 14th session of Employment Law 101. So if you've missed any of our earlier sessions, all of our videos are available on our website, npmlegal.co.uk. And you can actually also listen to all of the recording of all of these sessions on Spotify as well. So if you search for Employment Law 101, it'll bring up the Spotify sessions and you can listen to your heart's content. Tip number 9 from me is about bids and tenders. So just remember that when it comes to tendering processes, I mean, this often happens if you've been invited to pitch something, you're going after a contract, it's easy to forget that 2P might apply and you don't then factor in any employee costs, or whether that's redundancy payment costs or just a swelling of the headcount, you know, the employees that you're going to have to pay. So as part of that bid and tender process at the outset, remember to ask whether 2P applies to that situation, and if so, how many employees are in scope, what the employee costs are, because that's obviously going to make a massive difference to the profit levels of the contract that you're going for. I think the other associated watch out with that is you can't necessarily take what the company that's running the bid process says as gospel, because obviously it's a legal decision about whether or not 2P applies. And there have been plenty of cases where both parties deny that 2P applies, but affected employees think that 2P ought to have applied, and a claim goes in against both parties. So an individual would submit a claim against both outgoing employer and new employer and claim that there's been some kind of breach, and they'll just leave it up to the courts to decide who's liable and for what.
I think that's probably more of a commercial point. So if you're, you know, if you're asked to help when it comes to any tender process, if you can make it clear that, you know, you've asked the question about 2P, how many employees, if they come back and they say, no, 2P doesn't apply, you put in your bid on the basis of that information. Commercially speaking, it gives you a much better platform to go back and renegotiate on what you've bid for on the basis that they gave you the wrong information. That's the only issue there. Okay, finally, we said at the start that 2P doesn't apply to a share sale, which is right, but then what happens after the share sale? You bought a company, we're back into harmonisation, we're back into the realms of integration. You might find, and we've had this happen a couple of times, that just by sort of sheer operation of the business, you end up with one function in one company supporting across several different entities within the group, and then there are sort of moves to align that all. That in itself is going to become an intragroup transfer to which 2P applies. So just be alive to that. So don't think, well, just because it's a share sale, that's fine. The share sale will only not incur 2P if you leave the whole company intact and you let it essentially operate as it was before. But we all know in the real world that doesn't happen. The minute you pull somebody into the group, you're looking at rejigging things to make efficiencies, etc. So that's the planning point. That's the red flag again, where, you know, you think, well, I've got to be alive to the fact that 2P might well apply.
I think the case that kind of established that, I forget the name of it unhelpfully, but it was a scenario where company was purchased, but then the key management team was removed by the purchaser and they put their own people in. So, you know, like managing director, chief finance officer, those really key decision-making roles were pulled. So, you know, in effect, you're kind of changing the decision-making capacity of the company.
Yeah. And another time that can happen is where you just pull a function. You might say, oh, we don't need the HR function in that business anymore. And you think, well, that's a straightforward redundancy situation. But the question to ask is, well, what's happening to the roles? Who's going to be doing the work? And then, you know, somebody will say, oh, we're moving it to our Birmingham office. And it's like, well, who's in the Birmingham office? Oh, that's a different entity. So in other words, you know, there's a potential outsourcing of the HR function, albeit an internal outsourcing, just to really confuse matters, where that function is being picked up lock, stock and barrel and put into another company, in which case the employees who are engaged in that are fully entitled to argue that that's a cheapy transfer and they should be consulted.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for all your questions. Just a couple to close off before we wrap up the session. Just a comment from Elaine saying timescales as amended by the government. It's about time the timescales are amended by the government. It's 28 days. It's not long enough to do proper due diligence. I think it's super tight timescale, so I'd be inclined to agree. Emma's scenario about updating contracts across half the company, rolling out a new contract to the other half once they've separated the companies. So a change of employment contracts, basically, once a company's been split in half, can you still change the contracts? It depends. I think it depends why you're changing the contracts. If it's traced back to the 2P situation, then you potentially have difficulties there. If you're changing contracts for reasons unrelated to the transfer, and it just so happens that there has been a transfer around the same time, then you're obviously moving away from it being related to 2P, and it's a bit easier for you. But as always, none of this is legal advice, so do take specific legal advice on your situation and we can give you a definitive answer. Thank you to everyone who joined us today. Our session next week is going to be looking at redundancy, both collective redundancies and individual redundancies as well. So it does dovetail in with this topic. If you're registered for this webinar, you'll be automatically registered for next week. So you just have to join at the same time, 11 o'clock. Otherwise, thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday. Cheerio.
Bye.